This talk by Noah Levine was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles, California, and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
We all want to be, on some level, to have a pleasant experience in meditation and for the mind not to be too loud and to be able to just chill a bit. It's not always like that. It's often not like that when we meditate. You're fortunate if most of the time when you meditate, you're able to have a quieter mind. That's not always the experience for a lot of people. And ultimately, I do propose that Buddhist meditation is not about quieting the mind. Stress reduction, it helps to reduce our stress. It does, you know, to have that sort of temporary experience of calmness, it's really nice. But ultimately, what Buddhism is aiming at is ending suffering. Ending suffering in the moment of sitting here with a loud mind, without needing that chatter to end. Coming into harmony, acceptance, forgiveness, to be at peace, even with the loud, critical, wandering, chattering mind. Right here, and the mind is just spinning and not fighting. Just mindfully, okay, chattering mind, no problem. And I think that this understanding piece is very important. And I don't mean in any way to criticize or demean the desire for a quiet mind, of course. But I do want to propose that a quiet mind is not the goal of Buddhism. It's not the goal of Buddhist meditation. And I think actually it's the most commonly held misunderstanding of meditation. Meditation is going to make my mind quiet, and then that means that I'm good at meditating. Or it's a good meditation if my mind is quiet. Or that's the goal of meditation. It's not the goal of the Buddhist meditation, of what the Buddha taught about mindfulness. The third foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of mind objects. Not an absence of mind objects or thoughts, but just mindfulness. Oh, okay, chattering mind. No problem. So it's a long way to say my encouragement to you, to all of us, is to have a practice that can encompass the, as you put it, chattering. That doesn't need it to go away, but that is just, oh, this is just another part, just like cars driving by. I can't stop the cars from driving by. And they could be a real distraction. If I thought I had to really have silence externally to be happy, I'd be screwed. Because it's really almost impossible to find silence. Also, internally, we don't have to have peaceful mind in order to be at peace with the mind. Does that make sense? This is so important, I think, because this is really, and it's really practical and realistic, that the goal is to come into peace with what's happening, not to get rid of what's happening in order to be calm. So there's lots of ways to work with that. One is just, it's just a little shift in view. There's nothing wrong with a loud mind. It doesn't mean that my meditation is wrong or bad. Nothing wrong with the chatter. Just the same as the cars driving by or the sensations in the body. Just more present time phenomena. Just another experience to be mindful of. Loud mind, okay. Name it, note it, experience it. You can just watch it or you can just hang out in the body, let it be in the background. Either way. Often when we stop resisting it, it quiets down again. Sometimes it's the aversion to the chatter that's fueling the chatter. Not always. But sometimes when you just shift from, I really wish my mind would shut the fuck up, to it's okay, that then it settles. From, you know what I mean by that? That aversive, I'm pushing against, I think my experience should be different than it is. And when we come into, oh, it's just like this. It is the way it is. Loud mind today. Okay, welcome, loud mind. Let's see what you got to say for yourself. Observing it without getting so caught in the stories and the whatever it is that's spinning, plans, memories. Just watching. Okay, that's what's happening. Watching it like a, observing the chatter like a, like a science kind of project, like you're observing something. Like, okay, let's see what happens in this petri dish of my mind, right? See, let's watch the fungus grow. Let's see what's going on here. Mostly, that's my encouragement. Don't make thoughts into a problem. Make them into the practice. And yes, it's less relaxing and it's less peaceful of the sort of, and that's okay. Goal to be at peace with loud mind, not get rid of loud mind to be at peace. Because there's going to be all of those times in our lives where we don't get to sit down and get so concentrated that we can calm our minds, and we have the loud mind and the difficult emotions or whatever, and we want a practice that's practical. We want a mindfulness that's practical that says, no matter what's going on, I can be with it. I can be with whatever difficulties arise in a peaceful way, in a calm way, in an accepting way, in a wise way. Don't take your mind so personally. It's hard. It's, you know, that's core Buddhist advice, but it's hard. It's easy to say, easy for me to say, don't take your mind so personally. It's hard to do, though, in meditation when our minds start doing this. It's really easy to get identified, to take it personally and think, I'm supposed to do something about this. Part of what we're supposed to do about it is not take it personal. Okay, it's just chattering. We're not in as much control as we think of what our mind does. the one control perhaps that we have with lots of meditation practices, how we relate. If we're coming to meditation with the view, with the understanding that meditation means stopping our mind, we're actually starting with the wrong understanding. Which I think almost all of us come to meditation with. We heard somewhere that meditation means stillness and a kind of, we heard it means peace. So our idea of peace is nothing difficult happening. Nothing unpleasant, nothing loud. But the first factor of the Eightfold Path is understanding that the goal is to be at peace. To intellectually, like you're saying, get it. It's to be at peace with what's happening, not to manipulate our lives into a certain kind of situation so that only pleasant things are happening. To be at peace with the unpleasant truth of the mind at times. Yeah, it's really liberating to just know that. It's good news. It takes away this sort of, I have to be perfect. Or my mind has to be perfect. Just for changing our relationship to the mind. Of course, it is the goal of the Buddhist path to bring wisdom and compassion into the world from the inside out. And so this question about courage, I think part of what happens in Buddhism and what happened for the Buddha was he spent 7 years in deep spiritual practice within himself to make sure that he had the wisdom and the compassion to spend the rest of his life serving from a place of being awake and being non-attached to people being any different than they are, but fully passionately caring about the way it is. And so it's such a strange juxtaposition where we're saying, okay, now don't cling to people changing, but work endlessly, tirelessly, like a bodhisattva, like the sort of saint that you're talking about, for change, right? Don't be attached to change, but be fully willing to do everything to help create change without being attached to the outcome. Or trying to kind of think that we're actually in control. So courage, from this perspective, comes from wisdom. Comes from the wisdom to know. It's a little bit like, I don't know if you're familiar with the Serenity Prayer, but the wisdom to know the difference. Compassion is, in Buddhism, is the natural, enlightened quality of the heart that cares about suffering. Compassion is balanced by appreciating also the joy in the world and not getting so bogged down and only, and especially when you're working in social services or, kind of with abused children, and all you see is the suffering all of the time. Buddhism also asks us, please, acknowledge the joy. Don't get so focused on compassion that all you're seeing is suffering all of the time. Also, remember that there is beauty, there is love, there is joy, there is kindness in this world, as well as the grave suffering. Have some balance, right? Middle path. And ultimately, the teaching in Buddhism, in this, I'm not sure how much of a Buddhist perspective you bring to your very important work that you do, is equanimity. And maybe equanimity is what gives us the most courage, because equanimity is the wisdom to know our limitations. To know that no matter how much compassion we have for the abused child, no matter how much willingness we have to sit with the hospice patient, that our love, that our compassion, that our willingness to protect and serve and has its limitations. Has its limitations. That even the fully enlightened Buddha said, I cannot remove anybody else's suffering. I cannot reach into anyone and take away greed or hatred or delusion, which are the core suffering, causes of suffering in the human condition. Now, that's much different than, he's not at all saying, like, let's not protect each other. Let's not feed each other. Let's not sit with each other while we're dying. That's important, that courage to do that work. But that balance of understanding that even if I'm sitting with you as you're dying, I can't take away your suffering. Even if I'm protecting you, I can't take away your internal trauma, suffering. I can stop the external, perhaps. I might be able to. Sometimes we have that power to protect each other. Equanimity technically states this understanding. And this is where it's a little dangerous here. Because I'm with you with the injustice in this world. I look at this world and I see a lot of fucking injustice. I see a lot of seemingly innocent people being abused and oppressed. But the Buddha in his enlightenment said in the equanimity teaching, he said every being is inheriting their own karmic momentum. All beings' happiness depends upon their actions, not upon my wishes for them. Which is what I'm kind of saying, that with that courage, there's the wisdom to know, no matter how much I wish that you would stop suffering, no matter how much I wish, I love, I have compassion, and I care, and I really want you to stop clinging so that you stop suffering, to stop hating so that you stop suffering, to stop being greedy so that you stop. No matter how much wishes we have for each other like that, it's not going to end suffering. The only thing that's going to end suffering is when you stop clinging. When you stop acting out of greed or hatred or delusion. My wishes will not end your suffering. Your wishes will not end my suffering. I have to do the work myself. And so there's this very, again, it's almost a contradiction. Doesn't it feel a little bit like a contradiction? Where sort of we're being asked to work endlessly, not even being asked, it's the natural outcome of the compassionate awakening, that we say, I'm going to spend my life's energy trying to help. Trying to help create a positive change in this world, to serve. But the flip side of that is, we only have so much influence. Ultimately, the Buddha is saying, if you're not attached, you're going to be able to work tirelessly, endlessly, with compassion. And you're not going to suffer because there's no attachment in compassion and it's just selfless giving. But because we're not enlightened, there's some self in it. There's some attachment in it. And we're still suffering a bit. And there can be what some people call like compassion fatigue.
I think that's what I have. Yeah.
There can be a burnout. There can be a kind of fatigue in it because it's not pure compassion. I think that this is really, really important because sometimes I know I've seen in myself that I want to pretend like the work that I was doing in prisons for many, many years was altruistic. I'm going in and I'm helping the prisoners. But when I really started to look at it, I was going in as much to help to forgive myself as I was to help them. That what from the outside looked very altruistic, oh, Noah's helping the prisoners and volunteering and teaching and all of this stuff. From the outside, people, you know, say, oh, it looks like you're so compassionate. My motivation partially was to serve, partially was redemption. Partially was to forgive myself for all of the felonies that I had committed, for all of the crimes that I had committed. I was going back. Sometimes we're doing this, like you said, the trauma that you've experienced. We're doing it to heal ourselves too. And there's nothing wrong with that. but very important to acknowledge that peace, to not pretend like it's selfless, to not pretend like we are empty when we're not quite empty. Because then we burn out. And, you know, they talk about in recovery, you have to have it to give it away, mm-hmm. but you can't keep it unless you give it away. Mm-hmm. And Buddhism is like that too, I think. You know, the natural outcome of wisdom and compassion is service, is engaged, living it and helping each other, for sure. But there, we have to have enough. It's so important to practice meditation. So important to have these conversations, to be surrounded by community of like-minded people that understand, that support us, so that we're not out there in the world as this battle against evil, right, against suffering. So that we're kind of, we have some foundation for it. In that way, I actually think that our meditation practice is an act of generosity. Because the more it sort of fills us with wisdom, the more wisdom we're going to have to share. And if we're not practicing, easy to burn out. And even if we are practicing, sometimes easy to burn out. I was just thinking of just the sort of simple overview of the Buddha's Dharma and of the Four Noble Truths, and just how core, how like all of the Dharma, all of Buddhism is contained in the Four Noble Truths. In some ways, you know, and it's very simple, and in some ways we turn, you know, we've made Buddhism into this religion and we get it very complicated, and you know, now we've written hundreds and thousands of books about these four simple principles. Right? The Buddha, I think, actually kept it pretty simple. We've complicated it a lot. Simple but precise. The other night, how many people were here on Wednesday? Just a couple of you. We had this wonderful old Japanese monk. I think he's like, did he say 50 years? He's 75 years old, but I think he ordained in his 20s. So like 50 years he's been a monk. Great, great, great. And it was nice just to sort of be with him. But he was keeping it so simple that it was inspiring on some level. But on some level he was saying, you know, just be happy. Right? He was saying, you know, just remember that you're a flower and just be a flower. And to me, I liked it. I liked him a lot, but I also felt like too simple. The Dharma is simple, but it's also precise. The Buddha's instructions are very clear in how to be happy, not just be happy, not just don't suffer. Here is how we can end suffering. The Eightfold Path. Right? Having the right understanding, having the right intentions, being very careful with our actions on all level, with our speech, with our livelihood. Here is the way to be mindful on all of the levels of existence, in every aspect, you know, part of your question. Here is how to be mindful in every aspect of our life. Breathing, sitting, standing, walking, eating, going to the bathroom, having sex, having a loud mind, having a quiet mind, mindfulness of everything, not just sitting still, walking down the street, driving on the freeway, you know, stage diving, whatever you're doing, mindfulness in the process. And so I just, I don't know, I just saying it actually, I feel very grateful that I have such a clear map. And this map and this sort of guidance and these, you could even say this sort of step process. That for me, over the last 20 years of kind of practicing it and trying to apply it and failing miserably and burning out and thinking that I was being altruistic when I was really being selfish, and you know, and thinking that I had to have a quiet mind and you know, all of that, and just seeing, oh, actually the Buddha was quite clear about this. You don't have to have a quiet mind to be at peace. You don't have to be completely altruistic to be of service. It's okay if there's some self in there, in the process of becoming selfless. He kept it very simple, and I'm probably guilty of the same thing. He spoke a bit in generalities. You know, he said, yes, it's difficult. And it's going to, you know, take a lot of effort, and there's going to be some pain sitting still and such like that in order to gain the wisdom and the freedom that's available. You know, for instance, I asked him about sort of how much concentration versus mindfulness. And I really would have liked, you know, his 50 years worth of, you know, kind of a specific answer, and I didn't get one. It was a very sort of general, like, well, just, you know, be mindful and concentrate a lot, and, you know, kind of answer. But I got a lot. I also had that. Sometimes in these sort of teachings and with somebody who's meditated for so long, there is an energetic kind of what in Hinduism they call darshan. There is that sort of like just hanging out with somebody that's been kind of dedicated to it in such a full-time way for so long that you kind of walk away with like, oh, wow, that's really inspiring. I feel happy, but I'm not sure why. I feel inspired, even though I can't put my finger on anything that he said that was all that inspiring. But his presence was very inspiring. I was just reflecting on how Buddhism is, and the Four Noble Truths are created as a medical model. And that actually the Buddha was using the Indian Ayurvedic medical model. He said, there's a disease here. And it's a diagnosis of a disease and a treatment for a disease. And the symptoms of this human condition, this disease, is the uneasiness of being human. Or the first truth, the dukkha, that there's all of these symptoms of being unhealthy, of the natural state of affairs for human beings is an unhealthy one, right? Because there's suffering. And if we were actually in health, in balance, mentally, emotionally, physically, then we wouldn't suffer so much. But he says there's this symptom of suffering that all of us are experiencing. So there's this disease of suffering, of dukkha, that we're all experiencing. There's this strange imbalance here in our minds and our bodies that causes anxiety, that causes fear, that causes grief, that causes all of the forms of suffering, right? Every way that we suffer. And that the core cause of it is craving for it to be different than it is. The core causing of our uneasiness, rather than craving, I think it's, for me, I like to really see it more as being out of balance, out of harmony with impermanence. For me, I don't know, if you look at your life and what's difficult about your life, two things usually. Something about things changing and you not liking it. Right? Not getting what you want quickly enough, losing what you have, not being able to control what's happening. The change, the constant change. or something about self, of taking it all personal. And these are the kind of the two core insights of the Buddha, is that all things are impermanent and that it's not so personal as we think. When we come into harmony with the constantly changing nature of everything, when we come into harmony with the impersonal nature, and when I say impersonal, I open a can of worms, and then I also have to say that with impersonal, there are two truths. There is the impersonal ultimate reality, and there is the total personal responsibility relative reality. Ultimately, the mind is out of control. The body, sickness, old age, death. It's not who we are, not self. Ultimately. Relatively, we're responsible for this body. We've got to take care of it. We've got to feed it and bathe it and experience all of the sensations that the nervous system and psyche and emotional process within this body experiences. It's not our true identity, but it is our temporary experience. And we are responsible to it. But it's impermanent. The body's impermanent. The mind is impermanent. There's something else going on here. There is a spiritual process unfolding beyond the body, beyond the mind, or within the body, within the mind, however you want to say it. The less we, the more we're mindful, and I really like what Dina said, is that we can talk about this stuff, and it's important to talk about it. But until we really have the direct experience in the meditation, in the mindfulness, it is meditation that is liberating. It is having the insight of seeing clearly the impermanent nature of all things that will free you from suffering. When we really understand that everything is changing constantly, we will be less likely to cling, to grasp, to get attached. When we really get that in our bones, and when we have that insight, and we know it from the inside out, then we'll say, we'll get it. Why am I holding on so much? Why am I creating all of this pain for myself? All of this difficulty by holding on to impermanent phenomena. People, places, things, sensations, emotions, thoughts, memories. The Buddha says the cause of suffering is craving. It's true, craving for permanence. Craving for control. We could say it the other way. The cause of suffering is a lack of acceptance. Lack of accepting the impermanent nature of all things. Accepting that whatever arises will pass. Impermanence is such good news when life is painful. Aren't you grateful for impermanence when it's an unpleasant experience that you're having? This shit's going to pass. I'll be okay. It's going to pass. If we can remember that. Impermanence is bad news when life is pleasurable. It's all, everything's lined up temporarily. It's really good. It's not going to last. It's going to pass. It's going to change. And that's often when we cling, try to control it. And get the rope burns and experience the claws down the chalkboard, that kind of suffering of I'm trying to hold on to something that just won't stay still. so clear, I hope, what we're dealing with here. I know many of you practicing for a long time, you get this. And then it's our practice, each moment. How do I let this arise and pass? How do I meet it mindfully? Present time awareness, feel what's happening. Let it come, let it go. How do I meet the painful experiences with more and more kindness, more and more compassion? Moment to moment, trying. And that's the, for me, that's the only answer. When somebody says, well, how do I be compassionate? I don't know. Try. Actually, I think that that's the most important instruction. Just try. Because we know how, on some level or another, even though I know for myself it felt like there was a long time where I didn't know how, but it was through trying that I learned how to be compassionate. I would actually go as far as to say it's by trying that we uncover a latent, a buried capacity for compassion. That it's in here somewhere, but we haven't exercised it much. Thich Nhat Hanh might say that there's those, he's a Vietnamese Zen master, he might say that there's those seeds of compassion in all of us. We just haven't been watering them. And that that's what trying is. It's giving some water to that seed. And the more we try, the more we water it, and the more it becomes who we are, compassion. Mindful, compassionate. And then we suffer less. And our lessening of our suffering and our awakening isn't for the whole world. And I don't know if it's easy enough, if it's easy for you to make that bridge. But it really is. Because the more we wake up, the more we're going to dedicate our life's energy not to selfish pursuits, but to generous action. It's the natural outcome to become more and more altruistic and not just being of service to forgive ourselves, as I did for so many years and still do on some levels, but really just because it's a joy to serve. Because it actually becomes altruistic. Because it actually becomes, what else am I going to do with my life's energy? Play the stock market? No, I'm going to try to help create some positive change in this world without suffering so much about our inability to actually create peace on earth. With the wise understanding, the equanimity that tells us everyone has their own karma. Everyone's ultimately got to do the work for themselves. The work of the bodhisattva, like that little old Japanese man, is to inspire, is to encourage, is to educate, is at times to protect. But it is never the kind of magic that we think of, which is I'm going to go inside of you and remove your suffering. The bodhisattva encourages us to remove our own suffering. And that's the only power that a Buddha has, that we have as Buddhas, to encourage, to protect, and to inspire, to educate people how to do the work themselves. So those are some of my thoughts about the Dharma this morning. Couple minutes left. Any clarifications about anything that I presented? Or... Lastly, I will say one of my favorite things about Buddhism is that it's not a faith-based tradition. It's not about believing any of this stuff. It's, again, as Dina said, it's an experiential tradition. It's about meditating and reflecting and finding out for yourself what's true. It's not about taking it on as a religion and, okay, this is what I'm supposed to believe. It's about taking it on as a practice and seeing, this is my verified experience. Faith based on experience, not based on what anybody else has told us. Confidence based on direct experience is the core of Buddhism. So with all of this stuff that I'm saying to you, you know, take it, reflect on it, and if it helps you suffer less, then use it. It's a gift. And if it doesn't, then discard it. If it doesn't, if you really deeply investigate the meditative teachings on mindfulness, wisdom, and compassion, and they don't work for you, then they're not good dharma, and let them go. And I love that about Buddhism, that it's really this open-handed offering. It should be, anyways. It's not always presented that way. I'm sure I'm guilty of not always presenting it that way, too. But it should be this very sort of like, try it. Take it. Make it your own. Okay.